1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. This is Your Turn, a live call-in show featuring spirited discussion and debate about issues that matter to the community. Your Turn is sponsored by People's First Community Bank, the best bank in the neighborhood. Stay with us to hear what Northwest Florida thinks. Better yet, call in at 623-1330 and tell us what you think. It's your turn here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. Now, here's the host of Your Turn.
Thank you for tuning in. We've got 1 hour left of this version of Your Turn, the program I've dubbed Meeting Nonsense with Common Sense. My name's Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. To sign up for our free lunchtime Liberty update and also to listen to the audio version of these interviews, please visit our website at www.cfif.org. We now have joining us by telephone Steve Simpson. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. He litigates free speech, economic liberty, and property rights cases in the state and federal courts across the country. He was lead counsel in a number of different cases involving the First Amendment and other cases involving political speech as well. And that's what he joins us this afternoon to talk about, campaign finance laws versus free speech. Steve, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, Renee. It's great to be here.
If you would, please, I know we've had some other folks on from the Institute for Justice in the past, but it's been a little bit of time since we've done that. We've covered some issues. For example, certainly one of my most favorite would be the voucher case, which I know you guys have been intimately involved with handled down here in the state of Florida. But if you would, please give the listeners a little bit of background about the Institute for Justice. And for those folks out there who have their internet up, you can go ahead and pull up their website at www.ij.org. But Steve, if you will give them a little bit of background about the Institute for Justice.
Sure thing. We are the nation's only libertarian public interest law firm. What we do basically is we represent individuals in challenges against state and sometimes federal laws that violate the Constitution. We focus on four particular areas: free speech, as you've mentioned already, property rights, economic liberty, which is often challenging arbitrary or irrational licensing laws and regulations, and finally school vouchers, which you also mentioned. Beyond the school vouchers cases that you're aware of down there in Florida, most people have heard about the Kelo case, which was the case that we took to the Supreme Court challenging the idea that eminent domain can be used to transfer for property from one private individual to another. We unfortunately lost that case, but it's created a big outrage over the issue of eminent domain abuse.
Yeah, we may have lost that one at the U.S. Supreme Court, but I think we're winning that in a lot of the state legislative battles. Am I right on that?
Oh, absolutely. We put it that we lost the battle, but we're winning the war. I think I don't litigate in that area myself, but I believe that roughly 37 states changed their laws as a result of ours and other groups' efforts after the Kelo case. So yeah, we are making a lot of headway in the state courts, and we won a very important decision out of the Ohio Supreme Court late last year, basically going the opposite way that the Kelo case went, that the U.S. Supreme Court went. The Ohio court found that transfer of private property from one private owner to another violated the Ohio Constitution. So that was great news.
That is great news. And we continue to follow that one as well as things develop here, where we are in and around the Gulf Coast of the various states that encompass that area. Mm-hmm. Now let's move on to what I asked you to come on and talk about with us this afternoon, which is campaign finance reform versus free speech. And I look so smart, and really I'm just lucky, Stan, that I happen to book Steve for the same day, in fact, that a very important study was just released. Could you tell us about that, please?
Sure. We litigate a lot of cases that involve campaign finance laws as they apply to ballot initiatives. Now, most people know that campaign finance laws apply to political candidate elections, but a lot of people don't realize that they apply equally in most states to ballot initiative elections as well.
Steve, let me interrupt you for just a second.
Sure.
Give us a little bit more of a background, if you will, when you talk about campaign finance laws. Those are laws that many of us maybe know as McCain-Feingold, but give us some examples of some restrictions, maybe.
Sure. I mean, as a general matter, what campaign finance laws do is they say that anybody who contributes money to a political campaign, whether it be one for a political candidate or for a ballot initiative, has to disclose on a generally a public website their political activities, that is, the fact that they're contributing to a political campaign. The disclosure would include their name, their address, sometimes even their employer. And in the political candidate context, the laws even go further, and they limit the amount of money that people can give to political candidates on the idea, at least this is the argument, that large contributions to candidates may entice them to give political favors to people who contribute to them. The laws are very complex, and they attempt to kind of regulate all of the money that is contributed to a campaign and spent by the campaign. But that's really kind of the gist of it, is the disclosure aspect, which discloses all contributors to a campaign, as well as all the expenditures by the campaign, and the contribution limits, which limits people under the federal law. I think it's now $2,300 per year to any federal candidate by any person. But there are a host of other laws at the state level.
Okay, when you talk about ballot initiative, let's do modern day, in fact, today, an example. Today, voters in Santa Rosa County are going to the polls, at least I hope they're going to the polls, to vote on whether or not to keep. It's a referendum that enables the continuation and the renewal of an established surtax that we have here. It's not a tax increase. These funds are used by our local school, Santa Rosa County School Board, for future maintenance and upkeep and renovation and education. And voters are going and saying, yes, I support the half-cent sales tax surcharge, or I don't. Would that qualify as one of the ballot initiatives that we're talking about?
Absolutely.
Okay, so folks who maybe have contributed either for or against that effort would in some way be restricted.
Yep, that's absolutely right. Well, what the way it works is this. If you send a check, let's say, somebody sets up a committee to promote the passage of that ballot initiative or to be against it, and they solicit funds from you. You know, we need money in order to speak out to people and inform the voters. So send us a check for, you know, $10, $20, $100. When you send that check in, whether you know it or not, your information then gets disclosed by law by the issue committee or the political committee, depending on which state we're in. And that information goes to generally the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State puts it on a website, and people can go to that website, and they can search out, and they can see what political issue, what issue committees a person has contributed to. Our view is that violates people's right to privacy, people's right to association, and people's right to freedom of speech.
Okay, so the study that came out, and it came out today, am I correct?
Yep.
Okay, the study shows the real-world impact of campaign finance regulations, and you say it's shutting up and shutting out ordinary citizens. Is that right?
Yep, absolutely.
Because these citizens, give us examples. I mean, why would people care that, you know, their contribution is going to be disclosed? I mean, a lot of people may pat themselves on the back when there's a win and say, oh, yes, I supported this effort. Give us some examples that people in your study have cited as to why they may not want their contribution information posted up on a government website or made available to the public.
Absolutely. You know, mandatory disclosure is really a law that requires or allows the government and pretty much anybody else, in essence, to peek into the ballot box. So in other words, when we require somebody to disclose on a public website what their contribution is and who they're giving it to, we are in effect requiring them to disclose what their vote was, on the theory that people don't give money to a ballot initiative campaign if they don't agree with it. So when we put that up on a website, we're basically saying the secret ballot in this context is meaningless. And we think that is, we at the Institute for Justice, that makes a mockery of the secret ballot. So in thinking about these issues, during last election term, we decided that given that everybody thinks that, or most people you talk to tend to think that disclosure is a good idea, but very few have really studied the issue, we thought, hey, why don't we go out and ask real people out there what they think about this and try to assess the real costs, benefits, and burdens of disclosure laws. The long and short of it is, after we looked at it, what we found was in a survey, the survey covered six states. Florida was one of those states. And we first asked people, do you like the idea of disclosure? And not surprisingly, most people said yes. In fact, overwhelming majorities of people say yes, disclosure, we think disclosure is a great idea. Most people think disclosure is fine in principle. But when you ask them, hey, or tell them, okay, what that means is your information now is going to go on a state website, the support for disclosure then plummets. It goes from the 80 percentile in favor, roughly, to over 50% opposed. So it shifts dramatically. And what we then did is said to people, okay, if you're concerned, if you would think twice about voting because your information is being disclosed on a website, tell us why you feel that way. And the kinds of responses we got from people were, by and large, that this is a serious threat to privacy. It's a serious threat to my secret ballot. In many cases, people said, for instance, I'm a female and I don't like having my information out there. I don't want to have my personal information on the web. I'm concerned that my employer may find out how I vote and that could affect my job.
Yeah,
I'm
certainly
concerned
someone
about
in
a union finding right. out and that could affect my status with the union, that sort of thing.
Right. Those were the exact examples I was going to give. You know, someone in the education arena, you know, maybe fear of retribution or in the union situation if they voted against the position, because very often, you know, unions will endorse a candidate or a ballot initiative. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, they want to make sure that all their union members towed the line. And,
oh, yeah.
And that's one way that they could then go in. Well, then, are there any benefits to this disclosure? Did your survey reveal any benefits, Steve?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because, as I said before, everybody claims that they like disclosure, at least in principle. But when you really look at whether they look at this information, whether they ever use the information, it turns out that most people don't even know where to find it, let alone have ever actually looked at it. So we asked people, okay, name a ballot issue. A lot of people couldn't even name a ballot issue, but those who could, we then asked, tell us whether you have ever looked at contributor information. Most people have not done so. Tell us the top several contributors to any or the top contributor to any of the ballot initiatives that you are aware of. Most people couldn't even name that. Many people had absolutely no idea where to even find this information. So, you know, if we have laws on the books that say you have to disclose this information, we ought to be taking a look not only at the costs in terms of privacy, but do people actually even use this information? Now, if you talk to researchers, you'll hear them use the term cues. And the idea is that voters will take a look at and will rely on information by groups and individuals they trust. And I think that's true. If you think about it in your own sense that then you realize that you do look to other people to decide how to vote and to get information about voting. But what doesn't happen, what people don't do, they don't go to a Secretary of State website and look up contributor information. There's loads of information out there about, say, the impact of a ballot issue, what it means, and how it will apply. But I think, quite rationally, people are not looking at who has contributed to one side or the other. They're actually trying to find out what the ballot initiative actually means. So the bottom line of the study is that disclosure laws, despite their kind of appeal to people in the abstract, in actual fact, they impose high costs on political participation and free speech, and their benefits really are illusory.
Okay. Steve, I need to take a very quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about the types of cases that the Supreme Court is looking at this term regarding campaign finance reform and free speech. And then I want to talk a little bit about what we can as public citizens do to make sure that, you know, our anonymity is protected, which it sounds like, you know, the results of your survey indicate that's really something we should be pushing for. So can you stay with us through this short break?
Sure thing.
Okay, if you've got questions for Steve, please feel free to call in. We'll take those calls right after we come back from break. We're talking with Steve Simpson. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, and we're talking about the dangers of disclosure, the unintended consequences of campaign regulations for free speech and privacy. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Are you looking for a wild time? Experience it right here in Northwest Florida. You're invited to spend the day with the cutest, funniest, mightiest bunch of friends you'll ever get to know. They live at the Zoo, Northwest Florida. Get an up-close look at gorillas, lions, tigers, rhinos, and hundreds more fascinating creatures. View the 30-acre wildlife preserve on our elevated boardwalk. Hand-feed giraffes and gentle farm animals. Visit the giant snakes. Ride the safari line train. There are so many wild things to do.
The Zoological Park and Botanical Gardens of Northwest Florida is open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. and is located at 5701 Gulf Breeze Parkway. That's Highway 98, just 10 miles east of Gulf Breeze and 19 miles west of Fort Walton Beach. Call 850-932-2229 for more information.
Rediscover your wild side at the Zoo, Northwest Florida.
1330 WEBY.
Hello, this is Carol Barber, owner of Expressions of Santa Rosa, your connection for gorgeous flower arrangements, plants, gift baskets, balloon bouquets, and more. Located at Bell Lane and Highway 90 in Pace, the Expressions team stands ready to design and deliver something wonderful to the important people in your life. Just call us at 994-5381 and we'll help you express how you feel. That's Expressions of Santa Rosa at 994-5381.
If you're just getting into town and need a place to stay, the Emerald Sands Inn is the place for you. If you're in between homes or need an extended stay, the Emerald Sands Inn can help. They're centrally located next to everything you want or need. Shopping, restaurants, video rentals, auto repair, fitness center, local entertainment, realtors, and places where you can relax. In addition, many schools, churches, recreation areas, and government offices are close by. The Emerald Sands Inn offers an outside pool, conference room, laundromat, vending, and many of the rooms have whirlpool tubs. Whether you need a room for a day or a week, or need an apartment for a month or a year, the Emerald Sands Inn has it all. They also have the best rates in town, so make sure you check with the Emerald Sands first. The friendly hometown staff will make sure you have an enjoyable stay. Make your reservation today by calling 623-3821. Convenient, comfortable, affordable. You'll enjoy your stay at the Emerald Sands Inn.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
We're talking with Steve Simpson. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. To learn more about the Institute for Justice and how you can support their efforts, please visit their website at ij.org. Okay, Steve, right before we went to the break, we were talking about campaign finance reform, campaign finance regulations, McCain-Feingold. I think a lot of folks in the know seem to call it that. The Supreme Court has, I know, at least one case before it this term that deals with campaign finance reform. Can you tell us about it and any others that are there or that may be coming up and why we should pay attention?
Yeah, there's one this term, and the case is called Federal Elections Commission versus Wisconsin Right to Life. Basically, what that case involves is the extent to which or whether or not groups like Wisconsin Right to Life, it's a grassroots advocacy group that advocates on from a pro-life perspective, whether those groups will be able to run advertisements within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of an election that mention a candidate for federal office. The McCain-Feingold law that you mentioned, Renee, has a provision in it called what's generally known as the electioneering communications ban. And what that really is a law that says you cannot, if you're a corporation or if you're funded by a corporation, you cannot run an advertisement within a certain amount of time before an election. It's 30 days of a primary and 60 days of a regular election that mentions or even refers to a clearly identified candidate. Now, the bottom line on that, and this is my view, is that, I mean, this is, let's call it what it is. This is censorship. This is the government saying you are not allowed to publish something because it comes within a particular time of an election and because it's funded by a corporation. So the issue now, unfortunately, the Supreme Court upheld the law in general a few terms ago, back in 2003. Now we're back before the Supreme Court again to decide whether particular groups will be able to, in essence, get an exception to that law because they don't present the sorts of harms that the Supreme Court was interested in when it upheld the law in the first place.
How is it that any legislator, you know, who takes the oath of office to uphold the Constitution, I mean, how is it that they think that government should be able to regulate political speech and association?
Oh,
I mean,
boy,
isn't that what the First Amendment...
I mean, look, what the First Amendment says is Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or freedom of the press. This is a law passed by Congress that tells people they can't speak within a certain time of an election if their speech includes a reference to a clearly identified candidate. Now, how can politicians do that? That's a great question. I think the ones that really take their oath of office seriously don't. The ones that have been lulled into the idea that politics is somehow a different type of speech, is a type of speech that is particularly problematic or something like that, I guess have allowed themselves to believe that in some cases we need exceptions to the First Amendment. You know, it's hard to say, and really, ultimately, the way to combat that is for people to, you know, express the outrage that this issue deserves.
And do they need to wait until, I mean, is there anything that Congress is considering right now? I mean, we've talked about the Supreme Court. They've got the case that you mentioned, the FEC versus the Wisconsin Right to Life, which we're all going to pay close attention to. Will we get a decision on that case before the end of the term in June?
Yes. Yeah, we'll get a decision in June.
Okay, so we'll have a decision in June on that. Is there anything that's currently before either House and Congress that we need to be paying attention to that maybe we need to consider writing someone about? Or
absolutely. The one thing that's before the House right now, this actually failed in the Senate, but they re-raised it in the House, is what's referred to as grassroots lobbying disclosure laws. And the idea there is if a group that is very effective at speaking out to the public and getting a lot of interest in calling the government and criticizing, say, a legislative proposal. There are a lot of groups in Washington that do this. They're watchdog groups. They pay attention to what Congress is doing, and they call on their supporters to call a member of Congress and tell them that they should vote yes or no or otherwise on some particular piece of legislation.
Well, that's my organization. We
that's
do exactly
right.
That. Yes.
Well, with this new legislation that's been it's being pushed through in the House now, it's been kind of tossed around in D.C. for quite some time. What that would do is effectively it would require groups like yours and possibly even mine, even though we do litigation primarily, sometimes we do talk to people and say call your representatives. It would require us to disclose to Congress and to disclose to the public a list of all of our contributors. And again, the idea is if you're going to talk to people, if you're going to exercise your right to free speech, well, we need to know and keep track of your political activities. And that's very problematic because as we've seen in the campaign finance area, the first step is always disclosure, and the next step after that is slowly but surely tightening the noose and restricting speech. Because, after all, I think what the politicians who are in favor of this sort of legislation are really after is limiting the amount of criticism that they have to deal with. One of the interesting things about
censorship. I'm in the background, censorship.
Yeah, that's right. One of the interesting things about the McCain-Feingold law is that if you read through the debates in Congress, you don't see a whole lot of talk about money in politics, but you see an awful lot of talk about this or that ad being a particularly scandalous ad, or how difficult it is to respond to these ads in the 60 days preceding the election. Well, look, politicians may be upset by the ads that and the speech that's used against them, but that's exactly why we have a First Amendment, to allow people to criticize politicians. The fact that politicians are upset by this is not a reason to restrict speech. That's a reason to celebrate it.
Mm-hmm. You're right. That's what our founders stood for. Okay, Steve, that's all the time we have. Again, we've been talking with Steve Simpson. He's a senior attorney with the Institute for Justice. Tell us again the name of the study, and is it available on your website?
It is available on the website. The name of the study is Disclosure Costs, at the unintended consequences of campaign finance reform. And if you go to the website, which is www.ij.org, you'll see it featured right there on the homepage.
Okay, thanks so much, Steve. And hopefully we'll have you back later in early summer when we can talk about the results of the FEC versus Wisconsin Right to Life, and hopefully we'll be celebrating that case.
Yeah, well, I'd be delighted, and thanks again for having me.
Okay, thank you, Steve Simpson, ij.org. We'll be right back after this short break. Stay tuned.